This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
We are in the middle. The Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen set forth the principle that ignorance, neglect, or contempt of the rights of man is the sole cause of public calamities and government corruption. Such rights were said to be natural, inalienable, and sacred. And yet, even though all men were said to have been born free and equal, it was thought necessary to keep these rights constantly before the members of society and to compare them with the acts of political institutions. Emerging from the dark ages of divine right monarchies, of aristocrats whose privilege came not from their intelligence or diligence, but from a universal teleology that was never wholly abandoned by the educational, religious, and political establishment. From this came a new concept of man, a concept that was carefully safeguarded. This new man seemed to have emerged from the state of nature, fully clothed. That is, society was postulated as a place in which to order one's actions and possessions within the bounds of natural law. Freedom came to mean independence of another man's will, and this was because the free man would now be guided solely by nature's laws. In this way, nature's laws and not other men determined the limits of human action, and nature was defined as a state where no man has authority over another. In other words, a state of equality. The implications of this view are vast. Creatures of the same species and rank are born to the same advantages of nature, as well as to the use of the same faculties, and each is and should be the equal of every other in every possible way. Duties and rights, charity and justice find their foundation in this equality of natural advantages and faculties. And reason, which is the law of nature, determines that in a state where all are equal and independent, no one ought to harm another's life, health, liberty, or possessions. The first rule of reason, derived from the laws of nature, is preserve oneself. God's, or now rather nature's servants, cannot destroy themselves. The second, do not take away or harm the life, liberty, health, limb, or goods of another. And the meaning of this is made explicit. Men are to be restrained from invading others' rights. Justification for this view was explicitly derived from the new science of nature. Sir Isaac Newton was credited with proving that the motions of bodies on earth and the motions of heavenly bodies are governed by the same set of natural laws. The law of inertia, that of proportional force, and that of an equal reaction for every action, along with the concept of universal gravitation, inaugurated a machine-like image of objects interacting in accordance with inviolable physical laws. It was an image that quickly found applications in the human realm. Equilibrium must be maintained among men, just as nature's laws maintain it among the planets and the heavenly bodies. If it is the case that the tendency of a planet to fly off on a tangent is restrained and balanced by the gravitational pull of other bodies in its neighborhood, then this law must also be applied to the realm of men. Transgressors of others' rights are equally transgressors of the laws of nature, and they must be restrained and balanced by other men. In other words, they must be punished. And in nature, each man must guard equilibrium. Simultaneously, each man is an individual. Each has the same faculties and advantages. Each has the same rights and duties. Each is a little planet, a mass of matter, a discrete object following the laws of nature. And transgression of nature's law is thus irrational behavior deserving of punishment. In the state, as opposed to the state of nature, where men enter into compacts to form a body politic, the magistrate has the common right to punish. Thus, for the public good, for the sake of all individuals, each of whom is equal to every other, he can maintain equilibrium and punish offenders. When men embraced reason and self-interest, they became individuals, each one more or less like the next, with the same duties and rights. Guided by the laws of nature, the ideas of these men took on what has been called a furiously reductionistic, materialistic, neo-pagan, anti-clerical, democratic, and later still communistic and capitalistic caste. So it came about that the predictive and stabilizing power of Newtonian physics led not only to attempts to discover Newtonian mechanics in other kinds of natural systems, but in political, social, and economic systems as well. On this basis, it appears that when the rights of man and citizen were declared, they were of a peculiar kind. They were not exactly human rights, not the right to life, where liberty and security exist principally in service to the enhancement of life. They were instead the right to liberty, property, security, and resistance to oppression. They were put in place to establish and maintain equilibrium. And in order to achieve this, they were each in service to the final article of the Declaration, Article 17, the right to property. Of all the rights listed in the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen, only the right to property is singled out separately as an inviolable and sacred right. And only the right to property, and other rights are concerned with punishment for failures to adhere to law, with legal forms of punishment, with a prohibition on injuring others and society, with participation in public positions and offices, with responsible speech, with the necessity of public military forces and their maintenance. So it is all the more interesting that Madeline Ginn's and Arakawa's Declaration of the Rights of Persons and Their Architectural Bodies begins with Article 17. That is, they begin by rethinking the notion of property and what property might mean in the context of the right not to die. This would be a context in which persons are not simply born free and equal with the right to liberty, property, security, and resistance to oppression. This would not be a context where a person might simply be coextensive with her body and with the efforts of that body, that is, with her labor, which produces property out of self-interest in the service of self-preservation. For conceptualized in this manner, self-interest and self-preservation can only operate in a closed system for the sake of persons who seek to control the environment through property ownership. They lead eventually to an entropic state, a situation where there is less and less organization, less and less organized production. In this, we refer simply to the social contract and its denouement, as formulated by John Locke and Adam Smith. Insofar as the system was taken to be closed, with no new flows of matter or energy, it was theorized that humans could expect exponential increases in populations, while natural resources develop at a linear rate, leading to competition and life and death struggles for those resources. Indeed, universally, it appears that such struggles have occurred and continue to take place, and that the death of less self-interested citizens is the condition of the possibility of maintaining equilibrium. In other words, obeying nature's laws. And yet, as Ginz and Arakawa note, we think that we have discovered this or that pattern in nature, but we don't really know if what we are describing is what nature is doing. Applying and following laws can be dangerous. That is, context is everything. Thus, in place of a person who properties, Arakawa and Ginz proposed the concept of an organism that persons, but that an architectural body that extends not only to the organism that persons, but that is also inclusive of all that surrounds her, all that is within her immediate vicinity. In this way, and perhaps only in this way, will her looming obliteration, her apparent irreversible destiny, be minimized, as they write, to little more than a scratch on the architectural body. In short, this is a project for dreamers. This is a project for architects and poets, for artists, philosophers, and scientists, for those who go back and forth, those for whom inside and outside are the reverse and obverse of one another, those who welcome the cusp, that is, the catastrophe. In short, those whose interest lies in recasting and reconfiguring life. Having asserted in Article 17 the concept that persons should be considered as extending into the limits of that which surrounds them, Ginz and Arakawa, Arakawa and Ginz reconfigure the question of property and maintain that what such persons must be provided with is the means, the tactically posed surrounds or tutelary abodes to construct and invent themselves as free and equal in rights. What can this mean? The original Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen operated on the basis of what men are. It is clear to the framers of the Declaration that men are something quite definite, that they are born free, that they are equal in rights, that they are in the presence and under the auspices of a supreme being, that they are subject to natural and imprescriptible rights. But when persons are posited as architectural bodies in the biosphere, or biosglyph, as Ginz and Arakawa name it, what they are is much more tentative. Since persons, like all species, exist only tentatively, how can it be otherwise? The elements of the biosglyph must cleave to one another and cleave from one another in particular ways, this to that, this off of that, so that there may emerge different and fresh points of departure, tentative construction toward holding a place. Yet, quote, should a crucial element fail to hold its own, end quote, should there be a single missing element, carbon or oxygen, or an aberrant formation of a molecule, to say nothing of a large-scale cataclysmic event, would not the entire tenuous and elusive biosglyph vanish? So it seems we might be more cautious about making claims regarding what is, either for persons or for the biosglyph, and rather consider the manner in which all of it tends toward a tentative constructing, toward a holding in place, all, including this world, the organisms that person, and the architecture of such organisms. Such tendencies open up much less the question of the social body whose task is to remind and ensure persons of their rights and duties, and much more that of an ever-on-the-move body that will pose the question, what is going on? What's going on is that biosglyph, architectural surrounds, and the body in action really do not make sense apart from one another. What's going on is that speed is certainty, and certainty is death. And so a totally constructed tentativeness, a sure-footed and rightful hesitation, might be the uncertainty of a person who slows down, who hesitates, who follows tendencies rather than laws. What's going on is an evolving matrix, not entirely of the person's own making. What's going on is the slowdown of a person who is taking note of what is around her, taking note of her body's registration, of its immersion in a volume, held in place only by some demarcations that she might tentatively encounter as four dimensions. In any case, given the extent to which persons find themselves constrained by their environment, influenced in thought and action by their surroundings, where so much happens all at once and surroundings are spatio-temporally layered and themselves surrounded, then perhaps such persons, by slowing down, will also sense how their very movements architect such surrounds. That is, quote, a person turns a desert or a forest into an architectural surround by how she moves through it, end quote. By advancing and cutting paths, using her limbs, her gestures, her changes of direction, her speeding up and slowing down. Only in this manner can she begin to figure herself and figure herself out, to tentatively move in this way or that, to cleave this from that and this to that, to discover nature's tendencies and not its laws. We said above that for Madeline Ginz and Arakawa, persons must be provided with the tactically posed surrounds or tutelary bodies to construct and invent themselves as free and equal in rights. This is the meaning of procedural architecture. Perhaps because rights and duties, as well as the very definition of person, was constitutionally set forth in terms of what were thought to be natural rights, it seems that persons of our species live their lives largely as a grand unknown, merely coextensive with their bodies. How is it that this has not changed, even though our ideas about nature have changed? It is for this reason that Arakawa and Madeline Ginz turn to biotopology, that glorious meadow of knowing and non-knowing that may assist in bringing to light the uncertainty of life. For the mathematician, as for the architect and poet, the global shape and connectedness of space is the realm of topology. The Möbius strip is a two-dimensional topology, but an infinite number of two-dimensional topologies are possible. They include the infinite flat surface, the infinitely long cylinder, the compact Klein bottle, and the compact torus. Two-dimensional topologies are non-orientable. There is no way to distinguish right from left, left from right, outside in, inside out. Walk on the outside of a Möbius strip and you land on the inside. Keep walking and you land on the outside again. Mathematically, a torus can be turned inside out so that the interior surface becomes the exterior surface. But since topology is the mathematical study of the properties that are preserved through deformations, twistings, and stretchings of object, tearing is not allowed. One of the central ideas in topology is that spatial objects like circles and spheres can be treated as objects in their own right, and knowledge of objects is independent of how they are represented or embedded in space. Of course, life takes place in physical space. And life requires that we translate or project mathematical topologies onto physical space. Translating and projecting topologies calls for more than mathematics. It calls for poetry and engineering. Architecturally, the Möbius strip can be opened up to form a membrane, a surface over which to move, a surface for the body on the move. Mathematically, the torus is a closed surface, but if you cut through the curved surface of the torus, you reveal its curved inner space. Architecturally, if the torus is split open, it can form a surround. For the sake of life and for the right not to die, Ginz and Arakawa are induced to call for and create a new science of nature, a biotopology. Biotopology studies the global shape and connectedness of life, not just a field of study, the mathematical description of the spatial dimensions of our universe, but a meadow of knowing and non-knowing. That is, in order to consider not only the topology of space, but also to address the existential dimensions of the organism that persons, topology can be extended, expanded, exceeded into biotopology. In the meadow of biotopology, each organism that persons following her own topology. Insofar as she is not simply an abstract and universal individual like every other, she will have to be responsive to each and every moment, to even the slightest urges that are her own. And each will have to find her own way, her own reversible destiny. Her ever-on-the-move body organizes and redistributes, tracking and passing through her organism. Her ever-on-the-move body is the basis of diagrams that are, in turn, the basis of the work of procedural architects. In such diagrams, nothing is known. Everything is new. In relation to diagrams, approximative, rigorous abstractions can be made, and approximative, rigorous abstractions that tentatively commit the biotopologist to change on the move. This is perhaps the most difficult part of the process, taking seriously what is indeterminate. adhering to what is not fully ascertainable, cleaving and bioscleaving so as to hold open places where segments of mass energy rather than discrete objects may attach to one another, but just as well separate from one another in accordance with the diagram of the organism that persons, the body on the move. Thus, there will be landing sites, the exact positioning of segments of mass energy that must be coordinated by the organism that persons and must be given a surround in which any such coordination is able to be carried out. So it seems that from Arakawa and Gin's points of view, the compounded processes and procedures describing these concepts are initially able to be coordinated and perceived in the multiple point of view of the ubiquitous site house. Perhaps it is a site that fully registers the architectural body, that something that resembles an entity, but that nonetheless, quote, occurs as sequences of actions and interactions and loci of activities and agencies, end quote. And this body would move so as to expand into an architectural surround, extending, expanding, exceeding the body proper, choosing now this and then that point of view so as to eliminate boundaries and instead move through organizational levels from that of the so-called body proper through to the architectural body. Ginz and Arakawa relate the moving through and choice of landing sites in this very tentative constructing toward a holding in place, this purposeful guess, the architectural hypothesis, quote, here's the house we were telling you about. Granted, this is not what in our time most people dream about coming home to, they say. Granted, this is not what in, to which their guests reply, this heap? This heap is a 2,400 square foot hypothesis that includes a courtyard but lacks discernible symmetry. Since the house is relatively flat, piled up here and there at differing heights, entering it requires first picking it up in order to insert oneself into it. It is a waterproof, flexible, durable, and provides great insulation. Handles allow one to open up its interior parts. It's scary, the visitor claims, because it keeps changing. Volumes open with my every motion. With each push, it's changing right in front of my eyes. With each push, pushing open, opening. Indeed, how can we imagine coming home to a durable, flexible shell, one that takes its shape from how we move through it? What is house and what is body on the move? On the move through this house that moves through the body as a snail moves through earth and flower, which also move through them. I, for one, will find it difficult ever again to eat a snail, carrying as they do their own architectural torus. After a certain amount of resistance, the guests began to stretch their arms and legs, fingers and necks as much as possible. They discover that the formation of rooms and the lighting of lights responds to the directions and tendencies of their movements. They also discover that the floors are uneven and that the house expands and contracts with their breathing. The house breathes in this manner, quote, each piece of material on the pile has ribs or spokes that open like those of an umbrella. Ready to be activated, expanding mechanisms lie at 4-foot intervals. Depending on which setting has been selected, the house lies low or it expands a little. Getting some height or on the highest setting, it really achieves full stature, including a dome and a vaulted ceiling. I think you're one behind. Are you sure? Here, in this architectural surround, organisms that person construct their hypotheses and enter into them. They surround themselves with the ordered presentation of their suppositions and overcome their dualism. The words of Wittgenstein may now be reformulated, quote, environment, organism, person is all that is the case, end quote. The hypothesis of this house is that by living in it, one can research what goes into being a person, One can formulate one-sided awareness from the body proper to the architectural surrounds that form by virtue of one's movements and actions, to the large atmospheric surround, and then to that most difficult to enter sight, sighted awareness, where your actions cling to you and you tend to become the pet of your house. Seldom do we move in this way because for the most part we move quickly. We follow laws rather than tendencies. And as such, the role of the body that moves and sighted awareness do not enter our architectural hypotheses. Dwelling in the ubiquitous house on the snail setting is the most direct way to reorder, quote, sensateness, sensitivity, sensibility, one sensorium, landing site dispersal, sighted awareness, end quote. In other words, to reorder and recognize the feeling of meaning. The affective role of cognition, the feeling of meaning, is for the most part held to be untenable, unintelligible for philosophers. Wittgenstein proclaimed that the world, thought, and propositions share the same logical form. He sees the world as consisting of facts, which are existent states of affairs. And states of affairs, in turn, are combination of objects, which means objects that combine with one another according to their logical internal properties. That is to say, an object's logical internal properties determine the possibilities of its combination with other objects. This is logical form. States of affairs comprised of objects in combination are inherently complex and are either actual, meaning existent, or possible. It is the totality of states of affairs, actual and possible, that for Wittgenstein makes up the whole of reality. The world is precisely those states of affairs which do exist. The logical structure of the picture, in thought or in language, is then taken to be isomorphic with the logical structure of the state of affairs which it pictures, and the rest is silence. Such a view goes hand in hand with the demands of binary logic. I'm a philosophy professor. Couldn't resist. For Wittgenstein, the world is the totality of facts or state of affairs, not things, yet it pictures or models reality, and only logical pictures, pictures that are true or false, depict the world. Such a picture is a thought, and a true thought, he says, pictures the world. True thoughts, which are expressed in such propositions, can then be perceived by the senses, and as a whole, they constitute natural science. Most propositions are nonsense, he says, but philosophy should consist in true propositions, which are the analytic propositions of logic. Thus, the limits of the language of true-false propositions are the limits of the world. Logic mirrors the world, but lies outside of it in a transcendental realm. And so the sense of the world is not in the world, but outside of it. In other words, the standard for thinking and language lie in the realm of the ideal, in the realm of the sort of propositions that belong to binary logic and to the world of true-false propositions. Thus, in the world, there's nothing new to discover. There is only the exploration of what is subject to law. And outside of this, all is nonsense. Perhaps we can and should appreciate the extent to which these definitions are greatly clarifying for the processes of binary logic. But we must also recognize that they condemn everything outside of this structure to mysticism. On this model of reality, in accordance with the demands of binary logic, we can follow the laws of natural science that prescribe what is true and what is false, but we cannot follow tendencies. To do the latter would be nonsense. Must we then embrace nonsense in order to follow tendencies, or may we not move elsewhere, in the direction, perhaps, of what is excluded from this structure, when what is excluded would be the middle? According to the rules of classical, formal, binary logic, a proposition and its negation can never both be true. This is the meaning of the law of non-contradiction. Further, at least one of a proposition and its negation must be true. This is the meaning of the excluded middle. But in addition to the standard form of negation, this is black, this is not black, there is a non-standard form called contrariety. This is black and this is non-black. This plurality of tendencies is contrariety, and contrariety allows for the excluded middle. Any proposition may have a number of contraries, but only one negation. This is a good start, but thinking life as tendencies involves going beyond accepting contraries. It involves rethinking the context in which we invoke binary logic. Logical negation constructs differences in terms of exclusion. The true proposition excludes and backgrounds the false proposition, asserting its superiority in a hierarchical dualism. To simply opt for asserting both sides of any contradiction would be to assert nonsense and confusion, implying that to live and not to live, to move and not to move, to reverse destiny and not to reverse destiny are one and the same, when for the organism that persons, they are simultaneously affirmable. As Hannah Arendt has stated, such pure thinking cannot come into being except by withdrawing from the world's being present to the senses, retaining at most an intuition that makes present what is absent. This means that thinking often desenses. It transforms the visible world into invisible images, valorizing pure thinking above all else. The philosopher turns common sense upside down, absenting even her own body, as well as spatial and temporal distinctions. Arendt embraces the beauty of thinking, especially for its ability to abstract from sensibility and for the creation of those thought things called artworks, thought things that include poetry and architecture. And she cautions that even in the realm of the sensible appearances, the ground of those appearances does not appear. That is, our bodily organs, our neurophysiology, our sensibilities. What we sense are our inner sensations, whose relentless succession prevents them from assuming a lasting, identifiable shape. An unbroken sensation or mood would indicate grave disorder, depression, mania. Yet we must not forget that the fundamental ground of the appearing world is not just the sheer activity of thinking, but our inner organs, our depths. And a pure thinking thing without a body would not even know that there is a reality or distinctions such as expel, exude, and disperse with respect to landing site configurations. If by moving through the ubiquitous house, the organism that persons opens it as a multiplicity of landing sites, while simultaneously becoming the pet of that house, then perhaps what is being expressed is something arising from our sensations, which do not find expression in the classical logical categories of sense and nonsense, but in those of approximation and tendency. These phenomena can also be expressed in logical terms, but not those of classical binary logic. The logic that may be more appropriate to this sort of formulation has been called intuitionistic logic, appropriately characterized as constructivist and weaker than classical logic. Whereas classical logic insists on the excluded middle and demands that a proposition be either true or not true, whether or not there is proof for it, the intuitionist remains open to tendencies. A proposition may turn out to be true tomorrow or false. We may have to wait much longer, or really, it may never be clear if it's true or false. In other words, approximative, rigorous abstractions, as Ginz and Arakawa refer to them, become entirely feasible and boundary conditions recede. Such thinking reflects much less the ideal view of life and much more the still abstract but nonetheless physical view. Not the view from without, but the view from within. In between the binary propositions stating either that there is that there is an on-the-move organism that persons, or there is not an on-the-move organism that persons, there might well be something indeterminate rather than nothing. There might be the matter in which human snails, who carry their landing sites with them and sometimes swallow, then expel them, exude and disperse them as landing site configurations in the otherwise excluded middle, where the penchant for indeterminacy persists. And now, conclusion. Biotopology is the art science of emphasis, and it must also pay careful attention to the various scales of action that directly or indirectly contribute to an organism that person's ability to form an architectural body and so to function in all respects, say Ginz and Arakawa. Once we consider scales of action, the limitations of the naturalistic underpinnings of the original Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen become apparent. Already, Galileo had set aside mere physical dimensions of objects to consider structural strength, for small things tend to be relatively strong, while large ones are comparatively weak, as great steel bridges cannot support a load equal to their own weight, and any wooden plank does better. Moreover, the physical world is in motion, sometimes concealed by its slow pace and sometimes overwhelmingly swift. The relation between the orbit size of the planets and the time it takes for each to make one orbit relative to that of Earth made possible the plotting of order beyond celestial appearances. But if the 18th century admired the Newtonian revolution to excess, our present thought is equally caught up in the physicist's notion of energy. Once the value for energy is found, it holds without change during all changes any system can undergo, thermal, chemical, biological. Not only energy, but the values of momentum along a line, momentum in rotation, and electrical charge, once found, remain invariant. So we do not proclaim ourselves liberated from nature, for even in an open system, one open to new flows of matter and energy, constants remain. On the level of quantum motion, all electrons and atoms are identical, at least species by species, identical building blocks, identical and stable forms kept at an energy minimum and resisting any small disturbance characterize the atom. Yet unlike the large celestial bodies, the electron is untrackable from moment to moment, and stability exists only in the pattern as a whole. Although individual atoms have no history, what occurs is a reassortment of them, of atoms and electrons in stable and predictable patterns. Human snails, or organisms that person, are similarly autopoietic networks, continually recycling their components to change, to stay the same, to employ energy, to power the cyclical turnover of matter necessary to maintain a self. On the scale of cells, living tissues take up the nutritive material brought to them by blood and convert it into their own proper substance. Or they may transform their cell protoplasm into simpler substances, fitted either for excretion or for some special purpose, as in the manufacture of digestive ferments. Hence, metabolism may be either constructive or destructive. Autopoietic systems share three traits. They are self-bounded, surrounded by a cell membrane, a skin or shell that encloses the system, even while allowing it continuity with energy and material from outside. Second, they are self-generating. The entire system, including the boundary, is produced by the system. And finally, they are self-perpetuating, even when not growing or reproducing. They use energy all the time to maintain their complex form. The behavior of living organisms is determined not by outside forces, but by its own internal processes. And unlike an object which can only react, living organisms act. Humans in particular have freedom, a self-referential complexity, and this freedom and complexity are the result of our autopoietic closure. Aloofness, however, and self-identity of living systems is partial, for we are connected to the cosmos as well. Thus, we do not proclaim ourselves on our human scale liberated from nature and nature's tendencies. Insofar as the organism that persons is able to take up the scattered moments of herself and smooth them into a whole, she is a good enough person, an integrally intelligent whole, always capable of bringing conscious reflection into the mix. The organism person feels and thinks its way through an environment, Arakawa Ngensei, a thinking body, nerve tissue throughout. Thus, as each organ acts knowledgeably in its own domain, and the neuromuscular system coordinates and acts thoughtfully, architecture proceeds, conveying a world to be reflected upon, a world for global body thinking, persevering in that thinking. And such thinking takes place in the round, meaning there's something that this thinking would return to enter and return more than once, moments of an architectural surround. So in this, the procedural architect must go from nature to ethics. For, as Arakawa and Ginz say, ethical systems are not unconditionally supportive of life. Ethical systems that are not unconditionally supportive of life may be deemed bankrupt. Let us pay attention, then, to what stems from the body and so is of it, so that surrounds are designed to make the disposition and placement of sighted awareness readily perceivable, and so that surrounds may alter the proportions in which different types of landing sites are dispersed. This calls for thinking on many scales of action, taking into account biophysical, physiological, metabolic, and psychological processes. Let us also pay attention to the human situation, untenable in its current biosclave, and let us think and propose architectural surrounds that assist and add procedures for the body, embrace and cradle the tendencies, the tentativeness that precedes and accompany action, sympathize with the mutability of the moving body, discover the surround reaching out to you femoseconds before you find yourself reaching out to it, inviting you to be part of it. And finally, let us ethically reconfigure the supposed inevitability of our demise. Observe how the body adjusts to different enclosures of different sizes. Note how density and expanse change depending on the size of the area enclosed, on how the body lands on and holds onto its surrounds. Press the restart button. Start afresh. Become an as-if instant, Ginz and Arakawa say. Find what is tentative. Lighten your world, your imaging load. Play in a cleaving hesitation. Waltz with tendencies, inclined breezes and pursuits. Celebrate what life will originate, and celebrate what architecture will have become. Thank you.